that rises, ever so slowly, and presses the linen to his chest.
"Their belongings," he whispers. "Replace them. Repack them. The gold as well. And bring..."
He waves, fumbling.
"Catgut. A needle. Mr. Stilts, you'll seal this letter in my presence. The rest of you, the company..."
He focuses on them at last, but his gaze has no command and almost no recognition.
"Dismissed," he says.
6. A Life Worth Living. The lover you forsake in dreams becomes a wolf at daybreak. Run softly, leave no trace. Pass light-footed through the years. Or else lie down with the wolf. Let her find you. One drop of blood will suffice. Anonymous, Shoal. From 12 Centuries of War, edited by Thorell Agathar.
"A cure," says Mektu. "A cure for the throat rust, the plague."
"Apparently," says Condry.
"A cure?"
"Make him stop, saying that," growls Monsari.
"A cure for the fucking world plague, Con. You were carrying that around in an envelope and never bothered to tell me?"
"He didn't know himself," says Eshet.
"How do you know he didn't?"
snaps Mektu.
"And why are you always taking his side?"
"Because we're secret lovers." She meets his gaze, yielding nothing. "Gods," thinks Condry. "Mech's not the only one who can bluff." The council chamber is all but deserted. Only the travelers, Stilts, and Monsari remain. The fire is snapping and gnawing through a last armful of cedar. Stilts is winding a bandage around Chindelin's ankle. Monsari is trimming his beard.
"I told Condry not to mention that letter," says Chindelin, "and I'd do it again in a heartbeat. What you do when you open your mouth is as hard to ignore as what a skunk does when it lifts its tail."
"That's not fair."
"It's fucking charitable," snaps Chindelin.
Then he sighs and grips Mektu's shoulder.
"Knowing would have just made you feel worse. You just stabbed Lord Garatajic."
Condry slides the calfskin pouch, newly resealed, safely down into the depths of his pack.
"We should be celebrating," says Eshet. "Shouldn't we?"
"It would be unlike you to squander a chance to bicker like, imbeciles," says Monsari.
"Shut up and trim me," says Chindelin.
"We should all be celebrating," says Stilts.
"This is an earthquake. We may live to see the end of quarantine, the transformation of the world. Unless Garatajic is a liar."
"We can't even read the damn thing properly," says Mektu for the 5th or 6th time. "Why would he do such a thing? Why would he deliberately make it unreadable?"
The letter, as they all learned when Tabassa let them approach, switches languages after the first page, from Khosraji to some entirely different tongue, and only returns to Imperial Common in the final paragraph, exhorting Dr. Sirim to act with courage, but trust in very few, for our foe has a million eyes. Between the opening paragraph and these closing words are 4 mystifying pages. Not even the characters are familiar.
"He must have chosen a language known to Dr. Sirim," says Condry.
"He wanted to keep the cure a secret from everyone but her."
"What for?" says Mektu. "Why didn't he scream it from the rooftops, or at the very least take the cure to the Zavacendrans?"
"Lack of time?" says Stilts.
"No, not that," says Chindelin. "He didn't even try to contact anyone, at least in the 5 weeks I served him. Maybe he was only certain of what he'd found in those last days. He was acting oddly then, almost as if he were drunk. This in a man who never touches the bottle."
"But why only tell Dr. Sirim?" Mektu insists. "Why not 100 letters?"
He stands straight, cups his hands to his mouth.
"See here, world! This and only this will protect you from the world plague! Pass it on! Pass it on!"
"Money?" says Eshet.
"Very likely," says Stilts.
"The plague kills 1 in 7 outlanders, doesn't it?
They must want a cure more than all the silver, gold, and diamonds in this world put together.
You think he planned to sell the cure?
Jindalyn shakes his head. Garatajik was no mercenary. A quiet life and enough money for books is all he ever wanted. Or wants, if the man's still breathing. He'd never have muddied his hands with power and influence if his mother hadn't threatened the world.
What did he intend to fight her with,
says Mansari.
Not books, I think.
Your general ordered you to give me a haircut, snaps Jindalyn. Obey him, will you, and then clear out? We're doing fine without your wit.
Stilts chuckles. Let go of that bone, Smith. You forced Mansari's hand, or his foot, if you like. You're terribly dangerous men, and not even a child is permitted to approach the general in a threatening way. During the council, Mansari was assigned the guardianship of the general's person. If he hadn't struck you, he'd be breaking his oath. Mansari gestures with the scissors.
And if I had wished to break that ankle rather than bruise it...
Enough, says Stilts. We've no cause to taunt them any longer. Mansari makes an extravagant bow.
Forgive me, Master Ironmonger, I beseech you. And now listen. Your bags are repacked, your stocks of food and water replenished, your absurd boots have been replaced with fine desert sandals, your... curious notion of survival gear has been supplemented. Even your beards have been tamed.
He steps back, considering Chindelin's face.
Done. You are hardly ready for the desert, but you are as ready as 40 minutes can make you. And now we must be off. The night is passing, and the caravan will increase its speed at first light. We must catch it tomorrow, or risk losing it altogether.
He turns to Stilts.
The high road, is it?
The high road, says Stilts with a nod. To the travelers, he adds, there's a way into the desert that skips along the top of the Arig Hills. It's a marvelous shortcut, as long as your guide knows his business. In this case, he does, for that guide is me. He smiles. Mansari will come along as well, to the high peak of Ali Bat Sang. I shall see you all the way to the caravan, and I'm authorized to speak for the general. Mr. Ifamar will take you on, I guarantee it. Chandri feels a burst of affection for the Nadoman, but there is still so much he does not understand.
Why did Tabasa change his mind, Stilts? What did that letter mean to him?
It shocked everyone, of course, but with him, it might as well have brought the mountain down.
That it did, says Mansari.
We'll speak of that later, on the trail, perhaps, says Stilts. Mansari is right. We must go.
I will take them to the general's chamber, says Mansari. He will wish to say some last word before...
Stilts touches his elbow, shakes his head. Mansari lowers his eyebrows in a frown. They make final adjustments to their clothing, their packs.
Another march, grumbles Mektu, bending to tighten a sandal. I'll be glad when we're on camelback at last.
That day will only come if you are sick or wounded, says Mansari. The camels carry provisions, water, trade goods, sometimes a pregnant woman or a royal guest of the caravan, not lazy, tag-alongs. You will cross the desert on foot, like any common man.
That's not much of a joke,
Mektu stares at him.
It is no joke at all. You will walk.
Fuck a monkey, says Mektu. My legs still ache from the stolen sea.
He looks at the others as if hoping for deliverance.
Thank the gods I slept in that bathtub. It was heaven. Did you sleep at all, Eshet?
She shoulders her backpack. Her elbow, no doubt accidentally, grazes Condri's cheek.
I closed my eyes, she says.
Once more up the winding staircase. Stilts, again the torchbearer, moves with surprising energy, as though an old mode of being, an expedition mode, has suddenly been dusted off and returned to service. They pass straight through the high chambers, where no sign of their brief visit remains, save for Condri's teacup, forgotten on a windowsill. Beyond the servants' entrance are several further rooms, all deserted now, and then another long passage, broken repeatedly by lesser staircases. They climb half a dozen of these and turn at several junctions. Then Stilts slows. He and Mansari raise their left hands to the wall, fingers trailing over the stone. Stilts is mumbling, and Khandri realizes that he is counting his steps.
36 from the corner, he says at last.
Your steps are short, old man.
We'll see about that. With me now. He counts aloud, and on three, both men slam their shoulders against the wall.
There is a soft, deep click, and a door-shaped block of stone swings back into darkness. A puff of cold wind vexes the torch. Stilts looks at his companion, smiling.
Smugness does not, become you, says Mansari.
Beyond this strange doorway is a small, chilly room containing nothing but the dead remains of a fire and a small stack of logs. In the opposite wall is an archway, the source of the wind. Khandri sniffs. Clean mountain air. They have reached the cavern's end. The stone door is well over a foot thick and mounted on an axle secreted in the wall. He helps Mansari swing it back into place and marvels at how completely it vanishes. By torchlight, he cannot even make out the crack.
How do you open it from this side? He asks.
You do not, says Mansari. I will be returning to the cavern by another path.
He turns, glancing sharply at Stilts. The Nadoman is bent double, studying the floor. His free hand moves over the stone.
Someone's been here, see? And not so long ago. A day or two, at the most. What's your guess, boots or sandals?
How can I guess now? Snaps Mansari. Give me the torch, you lumbering...
you lumberer.
Stand aside.
Mansari, it appears, has some expertise with tracks, but after a meticulous examination of the floor, he sits back on his heels in defeat. He wags a finger at Stilts.
Ruined. Obliterated. Why didn't you speak up if you saw tracks?
I didn't see them till we'd all stomped in like elephants, he grimaces. We can hope it was a goat herd getting out of the wind. But keep your voices low and your eyes open. And I don't mean just for enemies. There'll be cliffs and cracks and slippery places along this trail, and we're going to have to do without torchlight, I'm afraid.
He snuffs the torch in the dead fire's ashes and leads them out through the arch. A great cloak of stars drapes the sky. They are on the spine of an enormous, barren hill, very nearly a mountain. The night is cold and still. On both sides, the ground falls sharply, decaying into cliffs on one side, rising in crags and boulders on the other. All about them are the Arigs, range upon range of black, heaving stone. A narrow path winds away along the ridgetop. The way is treacherous. The path climbs and plummets, and the stones feel loose underfoot. Chindelin shuffles, cursing under his breath. Khandri walks close behind him, ready to pounce if he should stumble, but not wanting to embarrass him by taking his arm. Suddenly, Eshet grips his elbow. She is far more frightened than Chindelin. Heights, of course. Her touch wakes his whole body to the memory of the bath chamber. He cannot steady them both. He should tell Eshet to lean on Mektu, but he does not. Only Mansari walks with perfect ease. Khandri recalls his first glimpse of the man, the fluid leap he made in the darkness, landing at Talopeke's side. Then Stilts freezes. His hand flies to his Madeline, and the others draw their weapons in turn. Khandri, knowing he cannot possibly stand alongside the others on the narrow trail, knocks an arrow to his bow. Mansari crouches low, one hand on the ground, the other gripping a curved knife, tip downward like a giant fang.
Who walks there? Hisses Stilts.
Only me, Commander, says a man's voice from above them.
Khandri looks up to see a dark form squatting on a boulder, black against the stars.
Spider!
Good, says the Nadoman. Come down, let's have your report.
Captain Sorfik here?
Mansari is flabbergasted.
Did you know of this, Stilts? When was this man dispatched, and by whom?
Stilts gives him an all-in-good-time gesture. Spider, meanwhile, turns and shimmies down the rock face, almost without effort, like a man descending a ladder, When he reaches the trail, he is barely winded. Telepeke's teacher, Kandri recalls. By the starlight, he can just perceive the blue birthmark on the man's forehead.
The path ahead is clear, says Spider. I've run it twice. All the way to Alibatsang. Not so much as a lost goat bleeding in these hills.
That ought to make me feel better, says Stilts.
But it doesn't, somehow. You drop behind us, but not too far behind. Stay close enough to shout a warning, if it comes to that.
A warning? Says Chindlin. Who in Jekka's hell do you think is behind us?
No one, says Stilts. And if I'm wrong?
Hill people. They're out before dawn, setting nets for birds, snaring rabbits. We must have scattered them like rabbits when we passed.
Still, you can't be too fucking careful. There are brigands in the hills, and ghouls, and worse things crawl out of the desert once in a while.
Yes, says Spider. Just look at what Talupeke dredged up from the stolen sea. How she loves her surprises, that girl.
He nods to the travelers, a mocking gesture. Stilts looks him up and down.
You're a good man, Sorfik, he says. I won't pull rank on you for talking down a fellow soldier, but if you go on speaking ill of my niece, I will shame you.
By kicking your ass.
Spider lifts his chin. She is a danger to the company. I will feel shame the day I betray it, and not before.
Stilts sighs. Loyalty's a great virtue, Captain, and wisdom's another. Now fall back, but stay close on our heels.
There is a hint of mockery in Spider's salute.
What happened between him and Talupeke?
Kandri wonders, watching him vanish down the trail.
How did he come to despise her?
Stilts is moving forward again. Kandri watches Mansari hurry to catch up with the older man. He murmurs something, a harsh question or demand, but Kandri catches nothing save for Spider's name. The Nadoman's answer does not satisfy. Mansari only shakes his head. The men's voices begin to rise.
It was not your decision to make, Stilts.
Someone had to act, didn't they? The man was comatose.
The general overcame his, discomfort enough to issue various orders. But not this order. What excuse do you have?
Excuse? That I'm his loving servant. That's my fucking excuse.
I do not wish to report you.
Go ahead and report me. I'll take the punishment. This is the world plague we're talking about.
Mansari says nothing, and they walk on in silence. Heat lightning sizzles. The forlorn voices of the owls ring from crag to crag. The path levels off, and the footing improves. Looking back over his shoulder, Kandri sees a few faint glimmers up and down the cliff wall. Fires still burning in the cavern.
Will you answer the question now? Says Chindalin. Why did that letter affect the general so? He acted like a man whose life has just passed before his eyes.
The Nadoman heaves a sigh.
I'll answer. It's not much of a story, though. You know that we're immune to the world plague, we Hurathis, save for an unlucky few.
1 in 8,000, according to the Zavacendrans, says Kandri. Stilts shrugs.
Perhaps that's accurate. I don't really know. What I do know is that the vulnerability tends to run in families.
Tell me, have you ever watched someone die of plague?
I have, says Chindalin, and it's a horrible sight.
First a cough that won't abate, says Mansari. Then a burning, as the cough irritates the throat. Finally the rust itself, which grows inward, closing the windpipe.
Nothing can be done about the rust, It cannot be removed without tearing the patient apart.
The poor souls can't speak, can't swallow, says Stilts. In the end they're breathing through straws, narrower and narrower. When the straw closes, they die. 1 in 8,000. Good odds, you might say. But again, the risk runs in families.
Stilts' eyes are downcast. When Tabasa was 16, the plague carried off his mother and her 4 other children, all his brothers and sisters, in a matter of days.
Kandri almost stumbles. Eshet's sharp breath beside him is almost a sob.
Jashar, says Chindelin. No fucking wonder.
His father became insane, says Stilts. He declared that the boy's survival proved he was illegitimate, that his dead wife had taken a lover. He started drinking, and then moved on to wax and grave robber's snuff. He died of the latter within a year.
It was not only memories that pained the general tonight, says Mansari. It was that he'd made sport of you, and that letter. Perhaps he came close to tossing it to the company to mutilate, or into the fire.
But he didn't, did he? Says Mektu. And now he's making amends. He's a good man, your general.
I doubt you truly believe that after tonight.
I believe it, Mektu insists. You and Stilt serve him, don't you? That's reason enough.
Hmm.
For once, Mansari sounds pleased. We have a last climb ahead, says Stilt. Be careful. The morning fog can wet the stones.
He sets off at a brisk pace, and soon they are ascending, mounting the shoulder of the highest hill yet. The rocks are indeed slippery, but Stilts keeps them to the center of the path. When it divides, he does not hesitate. When hazards loom, he warns them in advance. But five or six times, he pauses and gestures for silence, facing back the way they have come. Condry listens but hears only the owls' forlorn voices, far below them now. After each pause, Stilts frowns and shakes his head, then quickly resumes the climb. The wind rises, but their exertion keeps them warm. Condry finds his thoughts awash with all that he has learned that night. His father and the prophet. The treachery of Father Mars. Tabasa's heartbreak. And a cure. A cure for the world plague. A miracle entrusted to his care.
And that's not the only miracle.
He permits himself a smile in the darkness, remembering Eshet's kiss. Once again, she has taken his arm.
Horror and beauty. A broken general and a girl's sweet love. Has he betrayed his brother? Or Arikina, the love of his life? He is not certain. And yet, if he is honest with himself, if not now, when? He feels no regret.
Touch is a sacrament, not a sin.
Ari herself had said that, naked with him and entangled, on their last night by the streamside.
I'll never apologize for it, not to anyone, because I'll never do this unless I'm in love.
Hardly Eshet's philosophy, was it? Eshet, who wondered why he could possibly hesitate. After all, she was clean. But rather than guilt or confusion, Condry merely feels humbled by joy. These women. Great hearts, brilliant minds. Their honesty equal, if opposite. And he, the lucky bastard who is somehow, in a death-drunk world, a night of blood without certainty of daybreak, allowed to love them both. He and Ari had had just 3 minutes together, maybe four, after they both grew still by the streamside. He brushed her nipples with his eyelids. She turned the copper ring on his thumb. Condry looks east, where perfect darkness has given way to a pale egg wash of light. He thinks, of course the dawn will break, and we're running that way, running straight at the sun, and not just to save our skins. It is a great comfort to think of themselves not as killers but couriers, bearing the words of Garatajic, a good man sprung from the prophet's womb. And even the prophet had come from innocence, from the darkness of the orphanage, a prison called New Life, from the weakness of a 9-year-old Lantor Hingeman, and the greed of Father Mars, from the rage of a childhood betrayed. No, Condry thinks, he won't give in to regret. He won't drown in the beauty or the blood. He will be a survivor, like the general, a healer, like Arikina Nawal. And someday, when he is much older, but not yet too old, he will be like Uncle Chindelin, a guardian, or like Stiltsir, a guide. That is a life worth living, isn't it? Most certainly it is. The ground levels off. They are near the summit at last.
The path divides several more times, braided through boulders. Then, dead ahead, a last enormous outcropping looms over them, a stone crown on the hill. Stilts comes to a halt. Once more, he looks back down the trail. His face is in shadow, but something in his demeanor conveys a great intensity of feeling. Condry is unsettled. Stilts is not lost in memory, not dreaming of things far away. He is, Condry is certain somehow, concentrating furiously on the moment at hand.
"What is it?" he whispers.
Stilts blinks at him.
"I was thinking about the quarantine," he says. "Do you know, the moment the general broke the seal on that letter, all these years of struggle changed? The fight we've waged for our own little corner of the world, for the Lutaral, that can't go on as before. We're like ants fighting on a leaf. But there's a tree as well, isn't there? And we can't pretend we're not a part of it."
"Is that what the general says?" asks Condry. Stilts shakes his head.
"That's what I say."
He beckons the others close.
"Listen carefully. Spider should have given us an all-clear whistle. He has not. That means we may have company after all, coming up from behind."
"What sort of company?" asks Chindelin.
"How should I know?" says Stilts. "We can speculate later on. Just keep close to me now, and don't make a sound."
Mektu takes this as his cue to make a sound.
"Mr. Stilts, is that a staircase?"
He points at a gap in the looming rock.
"Quiet!" hisses Stilts.
"Yes, a staircase, you impossible fool. This is Alibat Song, highest point in the Arig Hills. Mansari is to turn back here, and I'm to lead you down the eastern slopes into the sand. But we'll all climb that staircase first."
"What, up to the Chalice of the Sun?" hisses Mansari. "Whatever for? If there are enemies about, they could trap us up there like flies in a bottle."
"We need to locate the caravan, brother," says Stilts. "There's more than one desert track, and if we don't spot them at daybreak, we might just lose them in the glare. Besides, there is another way down, and you should use it too. If we want to lose whoever's dogging our heels..."
"May be dogging them."
"We'll have no better chance. No chance at all, as a matter of fact."
"Another way down from the chalice?"
"What... lunacy."
"There is none."
"You see," says Stilts. "You don't know about it, and with luck, neither do they. Come along."
The staircase is barely 2 feet wide, a meandering slash through solid rock. The steps are tall and irregular. Condry cannot see the end of them. Up they climb, higher and higher. Condry feels lightheaded, watching the starry ribbon of sky above them grow nearer.
"Shame we're in such a hurry," murmurs Stilts. "In all Uroth, there's no lovelier place to watch the sunrise than Alibat Song."
Finally, the staircase ends. One by one, they step up onto a huge, square, windswept slab of stone. Wide as a castle courtyard. Featureless. Unrailed. Blackness surrounds them. No other peak stands so high. Condry feels exposed and weightless, as if the wind might hurl him from the peak. The stars envelop the earth, zenith to horizon, as though etched in a dome of crystal. Beneath him, the land spreads like a black banquet, even as dawn kindles in the east. A strange unease creeps over him. Something is down there, vast and hungry, while the night is bleeding away.
"The desert," says Mansari softly. "The land that eats men. Crossing it will be a mighty test. I wish you faith and good fortune, Chilodo. You will remember me, I hope."
"You've certainly made an impression," says Condry. Mansari actually laughs, a weird nasal sound.
"As have you and your... dear brother."
He starts forward, then pauses, as if weighing his next words. At last he glances back at Condry, resolved.
"Your father went to the desert as well," he says. "Nearly 3 years ago it was. Look for him at the Font of Lupriz, if you should go that way."
Condrey does not dare to speak. He wants to grip this strange man by the arms, shake out the rest of what he knows.
"Please tell me,"
he whispers at last.
"What is there to tell?" says Mansari. "He too sought the general's aid. I never saw the man in the flesh, but I gather he was quite the, salesman."
"What was he selling?" Mansari's eyebrows lift.
"Victory over the prophet. What else?"
He starts forward again.
"Now then, Mr. Stilts, about this second way down."
The light grows by the minute. From the north end of the terrace, Stilts beckons to them with some urgency. Mansari glides toward him. Condrey and the others trail in his wake. Mist is curling around the edge of the north cliff. Stilts, slow and deliberate now, walks right up to the precipice. Gingerly, he leans over the edge, peering down into billowing whiteness. Condrey bites his lips. The man looks small and vulnerable, with the wind whipping his traveling cloak, revealing pale, thin ankles and a scar below the knee. He is smiling slightly, but Condrey is certain the look is forced. The cliff's edge is eroded, strewn with gravel. What the hell can he be looking for?
"Mind your balance," Stilts calls over the wind.
"I trust you are not warning me," says Mansari.
While the others hesitate, Mansari walks to the cliff's edge with a nonchalance that is almost arrogant. Condrey draws a sharp breath but resists the urge to call out, "Tightrope walker, circus freak." Still, he finds himself annoyed with Mansari, who shows not the least patience with the older man's unease. Stilts creeps closer, pointing at something far below their feet. Mansari leans back into him, sighting down his arm. For an instant, they look like dancers holding a difficult pose. Then Mansari shakes his head, frowning, and Stilts pushes him from the cliff.
"I wasn't, no," he says.
The sound of impact is a long time in coming. The cliff must be taller than Condrey thought. But at last he hears it, a flat thud like a sack of grain slapped down on a barn floor.
"Right, who's next?" says Stilts.
Condrey does not think. Someone or something thinks for him. He whips his bow from his back and snatches an arrow from the quiver and trains it on Stilts and draws. The Naduman watches him, impassive. He takes one careful step away from the cliff. Eshet gasps. Beside her, Chindelin's expression is horror-struck, but he is no longer facing Stilts. Bow held steady, Condrey looks over his shoulder. Rasanga. They are closing already, stealthy as cats. Two women and two men. All four enormous, their eyes blazing with satisfaction, with hate. The men have bows of their own, drawn and pointed at the brothers' chests.
"We'll take that letter now," says Stilts.
As always, the commandos are led by a woman. Condrey knows her at a glance, by the long, straight scars on her cheek, like the mark of a bear. She is the one who confronted the Ersad at the city gate, the one who brought the white child. A madiglin twitches in her hand.
"Surrender," she says quietly. "The chase is ended. My archers cannot miss."
"Neither can I," says Condrey.
"If you kill me," says Stilts,
"my sisters here will draw out your Parthen whore's suffering for a year, or a decade."
His sisters. Ong's tears, the man's a believer.
"The Parthen whore," says Eshet, looking steadily at the archers, "will throw herself over the cliff, and you'll still be dead."
Chindelin sighs expansively and rubs his face. He looks suddenly, unafraid, merely angry and exhausted.
"Matter of fucking fact!"
His big arms sweep outward, catching Mektu and Eshet in a violent embrace. With three long steps, he hauls them right to the cliff's edge. They stand there, conjoined, a few paces from Stilts.
"You'll take no prisoners back to Eternity Camp," says the smith. "Corpses, maybe. But corpses feel no pain."
"Very good, Mr. Chindelin," says Stilts.
You've discovered the second way down I spoke of.
The only way.
But shift a little to your left.
Shut your dog's anus of a mouth, says Chindelin. Condry, if that bastard moves a finger...
He dies, says Condry. That's a promise, Mr. Stilts. Not Uman, says the Rasanga with the bear claw scars. Which one of them carries this letter of cure?
The one who just promised to shoot me, says Stilts. It's in the pack he's wearing, along with some suicide pills. I expect he's wishing he'd thought to distribute.
But the letter is a fake, holy sister. An attempt to divide us by casting doubt on Lord Garatajic. They're clever, these four. They chose Garatajic because he's a scholar and a pilgrim, and has walked in far-off lands. As if either fact could turn a son of heaven into a traitor.
Lord Garatajic speaks for himself, says Bearclaw.
Even now, with death staring him in the face, some part of Condry registers the word. Speaks. Garatajic is alive.
Condry, says Stilts, you must step off the cliff. Do it now while you can.
Shut the fuck up!
If they take hold of you...
Be silent, Naduman, growls Bearclaw. The Prophet wants them alive.
And you have never understood these two, says Stilts. First you mistook them for killers in the service of your enemies. Now you mistake them for cowards, afraid to jump. You have a problem on your hands.
What problem, Harach?
Says the second archer, with a twitch of his eye.
If they choose to jump, that is the will of heaven.
Not the devil, says Stilts. These are the twin abominations. Surely they answer to him.
The old one's tongue is free today,
growls the second woman, turning a knife in her hands.
I can change that, mistress.
Bearclaw studies them in silence, as when she stood at the gate of Mab Makutin, facing a mob hungry for her death. There is nothing in her expression but confidence and purpose.
Condry, says Stilts, almost pleading.
Jump.
Deep in Condry's mind, a voice is howling. Torture, misery, defeat. He pushes that voice aside with all his strength.
They want us above all things. But they also want the letter. To clear Garatajic's name or condemn him.
Use it. Threaten to destroy it. Pull it out of your pack.
Impossible. As impossible as fighting your way past these monsters, even if their arrows somehow missed.
Bearclaw walks over to the first archer, rock solid behind his bow, and pulls something free of his belt. A coil of rope, light and strong. She reaches into his quiver and removes a second arrow and ties the rope to the base of the arrow, tests the knot, then whispers in his ear. The archer, blindingly fast, relaxes his bow just long enough to drop his own arrow and aim again with the arrow tied to the rope. Bearclaw looks directly at Condry.
The Naduman is right, she says. You're no fool. You can see what will happen if you do not relent. The arrowhead is barbed. Our brother will shoot your brother in the shoulder, and the rope will detain him long enough for us to take him in hand. Then the agony will start. But who can say how long it will endure?
Mektu's eyes are downcast. The howl in Condry's chest will not much longer be silenced.
The black worms will not be the worst of it, says Bearclaw.
The Prophet's interrogators have rooms full of wasps, rooms of heat, rooms of drowning, rooms like iron jaws that slowly close. He will be starved, then offered a meal of human fingers. He will be given drugs to induce madness, although the latter will not be needed very long. And then there is the child. The white child, that is. She will feast on his soul. Already her mouth waters for it. You may kill yourself, but your brother will live on in pain beyond all description.
Condry's mind is bleeding. No way out. No way out.
Tell Mech to jump before they shoot him. Once he's airborne, the rest of us can follow. End it now, brother, uncle, lover, you yourself, in the last splatter of limbs.
Or shoot Mech yourself, Condry. That would do it. Shoot your brother in the heart.
No.
All eyes snapped to Mektu, standing there crooked by the cliff.
No,
says Mektu again.
That is not what is going to happen here. You, Rasanga, you are going to ride away and tell the prophet that you could not find us. That we were not in Mab Makutan after all. That the trail has gone cold.
Stilts chuckles. The Rasanga gape. But they do not speak the lines Mektu needs them to speak, so he plays the part himself, cocking his head to one side and offering a fair, almost excellent impression of Bearclaw's voice.
Ride away? Are you a lunatic as well as an assassin?
Mektu answers the question in his own voice.
I don't believe I am.
And again, as Bearclaw.
Ride away? Lie to her radiance? Why would we do that, you maggot in the offal of hell?
His own voice.
Because I'm not a maggot. And I'm not Mektu Hingeman, either. Do you know what I am? I think you do. I think you're beginning to see.
No one breathes. Mektu's eyelids droop a little. He gives the Rasanga a sly little smile. Liquid fire fills Khandri's temples. He screams, so loud that birds lift from the rocks beyond the terrace. His vision reddens, but somehow he keeps the arrow trained on Stilts. Mektu's eyes roll back in his head.
You will go now,
he says. The pain in Khandri's head ebbs almost as swiftly as it came, but the horror only deepens. Mektu's voice is not his own, not even a distorted version of his own. Chindelin snatches his hand from Mektu's shoulder, appalled.
You will go, because you love your prophet, honored dreamers. And I do not love her, nor any creature of blood and bone and awkward flesh.
An unearthly voice, reedy and sharp, like wind sighing beneath a door.
You know me by my deeds, says Mektu. I am the thief of souls. I came among you quietly, a petitioner. I joined you at the Feast of the Boar. I paid homage to your enlightened one, but she spared me no thought, no simple courtesy. It is hard to cross all the wastes of Uroth, only to be turned aside. I departed, honored dreamers, but I left my calling card. That was my right, you will allow. I took the brothers Hingeman as my instruments. I led them to Lord O'Julon, and they bid him goodbye on my behalf.
Play-acting, snarls Bearclaw.
You take us for children. A mummer's jape will not save you. We will—
Another cry of pain. It is Stilts this time, bending double, hands on knees. His face is clenched and his eyes squeezed shut. What the fuck is happening? Khandri is as lost as his enemies. His brother makes a mewling sound like a cat.
The Nadoman is in league with them,
says the archer with the tethered arrow.
Let us shoot him first, mistress. He is mocking us, mocking her radiance.
Stilts waves his hands at them desperately. He sucks in a great breath as though surfacing from a dive, but before he can exhale, a new spasm of pain racks his body. His knees buckle. He sways toward the precipice, making no move to save himself. Soundless, he rolls over the cliff. I've gone mad, thinks Khandri. The whole world has gone mad. But madness does not stop him from swinging the bow to point at Bearclaw.
The emperors of old loved me better,
says the thing that is not Mektu.
They knew what some forget in latter days, that only courtesy divides us from the beasts. Withdraw, noble Rasanga. These brothers shall be my conveyance across the sands. Mistress, it is the Yatra,
says the second archer.
Let me kill it. Give the word. If you kill this body, I will seek another,
says the thing.
Yours, perhaps, if you are strong enough. If the vessel does not burst.
Yatra, says Bearclaw. Do not threaten us. You know nothing of the Rasanga if you think we bow to fear.
All the world knows your courage,
says the voice.
No, you do not fear to die. But have a care, have a care. Is there not one death that would frighten you? Is there not one whose passing would extinguish the sun?
Shoot him, says the Rasanga with the knife.
She would not receive me, says Maktu. Though I came with gifts and compliments, and a message from the pilgrims of the void. What could I do, great warriors? I went away, but I left my gift, so carefully chosen, a thing made just for her. It is a shawl of darkness, and she wears it yet.
Creature!
Mektu's body jerks. His arms snap up. His posture straightens.
God!
He shouts, in an entirely new voice, a woman's, reedy and thin.
Why don't you answer me? Jihulkra, are you there?
Sheer horror on the Rasanga's faces. The voice is unmistakable. Even Khandri feels a chill.
Guards!
Shrieks Mektu.
What has happened to the daylight? Where are my sons? There is a weight upon me. Get it off!
His lips curl. He looks at his arms with astonishment, with disgust. He claws at his shoulders. He screams.
Get it off! Get it off me!
He falls writhing on the stone. His nails tear at his collar. Spittle flies from his mouth.
All a lie,
says Bearclaw, but her voice is hollow. She cannot tear her eyes from the man before her. Mektu's nails are bloody, and his lips. He has bitten his tongue.
It will kill her! Kill the prophet!
Cries the archer with the tethered arrow. He turns a wild, almost mutinous glance on his commander. And Khandri, his mind clear as glass, closes one eye and shoots the archer through the throat. He has sealed his own death, of course. The second archer whirls and fires at him and cannot possibly miss. His last thoughts are wordless flashes, lightning of the mind. The sweetness of moments. Naked with Arikina, with Eshet. The joining spasm and the snuggling afterwards. Joys of home. Greyback geese over blind stream. Wolf pups on Candle Mountain. The old man's grin. Diakra's singing voice. Ari's eyes on you, believing in you, loving what she alone could see. Your spark. That sacrament. The well of fire calling you to drink. The arrow misses. The archer's hands grope for the sky. 50 feet back from the cliff, an old woman with silver hair rises from a throwing stance. Beside her stand 3 soldiers, among them Talupeke. And the archer, he has been skewered by a spear.
Khandri, gods! Bellows Chindelin.
Then the blades and the madness. Bearclaw flies at Khandri and nearly kills him before he can drop the bow and draw his machete. It is his uncle who saves him by hurling his axe. The Rasanga flexes backward, an impossible contortion. The axe just grazes her chin. Khandri has the machete now, but he is not remotely her equal. Blindingly fast, she drives him back toward the cliff, parrying, flailing, 1 step ahead of death. No hope. The blades crash, his arm is wrenched. No balance. She could take 3 of him. He can't breathe, can't sustain this. He will not see the final blow. Bearclaw screams. A knife juts from her shoulder, buried to the hilt. Without reaching for it, she shifts the madeglin to her left hand. But now Khandri has recovered. He jumps away from the cliff and strikes, a killing overhead slash. He sees her eye, the calculation, the astonishing response. Once again she twists aside just in time. But she has forgotten the knife. The machete strikes the hilt, gouging open the wound. Khandri whirls away from her counterattack and then whirls again. She is still driving him, still the better fighter, with 1 arm limp and gushing like a spring. He parries. He leaps and feints, never letting her close on him, never landing a blow.
Don't stumble. Don't give her 1 fucking inch. You will die, abomination. You and your brother, on Rasanga Steel.
Is she even human? Where can she be hiding so much blood?
The white child will find you. The dagger of remorse will bleed you dry. The prophet's justice is as certain as the sun.
In the warrior's eyes, Khandri no longer sees hatred, only wonder and a curious need to be heard.
All Uroth will be her kingdom. Her feet walk heaven's path.
When she falls, he hears her teeth crack on the terrace and recognizes the knife.
The last Rasanga?
Talupeke turns to look at him, draws a finger across her throat.
She didn't fight half as well as her mistress, but she was still a beast. It took all of us to bring her down. Khandri, I saw your brother. What the fuck was he?
Not yet, Tal, he begs. The girl is shaking and twitchy. Freckles of blood are drying on her cheeks.
Tell me this, at least, she says. How did these bastards know you were here?
Khandri shuts his eyes, but there is no way to erase what he has seen. Stilts, their friend, her uncle, calling Mansari to the cliff's edge, pointing down into the mist.
I couldn't say, he tells her.
It is not altogether a lie. Chindlin draws near. Talupeke gives him a long, steady look. She hides her right hand, but Khandri has seen it already, his uncle's bright steel ring.
Talupeke, says the smith.
What in Ong's name are you doing here? How did you know?
I didn't, she says. It was the general. He had a hunch. Ever since the Maghreb, we've known that the traitor in our ranks served the Prophet. And then you appear, the worst enemies the Prophet's ever seen. The traitor wouldn't dare let you escape. So the general kept 5 or 6 pairs of eyes on you at every minute. That's why you were put in the high chambers, you know. Because every room has a spy hole.
She glances from Khandri to Eshet and back again.
Every room, she repeats.
Chindelin's eyebrows climb.
No one tried anything in the cavern, says Talupeke. So that left the path through these hills. But hours after you left, he woke up shouting orders. He'd guessed the real situation, that the Prophet had been tipped off much earlier and had forces waiting for you on the path. That's why we're here.
I wish he'd sent more fighters from the start, says Khandri.
What if one of them had turned out to be the traitor, says Talupeke. You'd have been too easy to kill in the darkness on that trail. A knife in the ribcage, a wire around the throat. No, the general only dared to send his best, the ones he'd trust with his own life. Where are they, anyway? Where are Mansari and Stilts?
The men look at each other.
Khandri doesn't intend to say a word. Fuck the truth. It can wait. But the scalding doubt in his own mind, what is he to do with that?
He had given Stilts more than his trust. He had started to love the man.
What could have turned the general's closest aide into a creature of the Prophet? And is that truly what he was? That madness, that unblinking zeal he had seen in the eyes of so many fanatics, was there even a glimmer of it in Stilts?
Khandri clears his throat. This girl knows them. She can read their looks and silences. In another heartbeat, she will grasp it all.
We lost them, Khandri hears himself say.
I'm sorry. We lost them in the dark.
So you climbed up here and got cornered. That was bright.
She wipes the sweat from her chin.
Well, fuck, we go on without them. General's orders. My unit will bring you to the caravan and travel on with you from there.
You will? All the way?
Chindelin's face is a door flung open to the sun.
All the way to Kasralis, says Talupeke. I'm to see that letter delivered to the doctor's hand. If we find the others, Stilts will join us. Mansari will go back.
Khandri glances sidelong at his uncle.
Back to the cavern, you mean?
Talupeke shakes her head.
The cavern's lost, she says. The Prophet's men attacked an hour after you left. They must have marched all night, from the battlefields up north. They were ragged, but there was no end to them, and they knew just where to find us. Someone led them to the cavern's mouth.
She bends over and spits.
One day, she says, I'm going to cut the head off that son of a whore.
Did the general escape?
Asks Chindelin. Talupeke straightens, glaring at him.
He will, she says. This isn't the way he's meant to die.
Her voice is sharp, defensive. She looks at each of them in turn. He sat there, watching me pack for the desert, she says. I've never seen him look so old. I've never seen him look old at all. When I finished, he called me over. All my life, I've prayed for things to change, he said. For this damned war to shift in our favor. For power to flow into our hands. I want children like you to have something you can nourish. Something more than what I've given you, these armfuls of smoke. Tonight, Ong, forgive me. I failed to notice that the change I prayed for was beginning. And why? Because I am not the chosen instrument. Because I will be an afterthought when the stories are told. Go quickly. Find them before the prophet does. They may be all the legacy we have. Then he kissed me and pointed at the door. And I'll never see him again.
You don't know that, says Condry. Telepeke is trembling.
I wanted to talk. I wanted to give him some fucking promise, but I just stood there. The god was interfering. The god wouldn't let me speak.
Chindelin puts his hands on her shoulders. She flinches, baring her teeth.
Tabasa knows, says the smith. Why else would he trust you with those words?
You're a foolish old man, says Telepeke, in tears.
Condry turns away from them. He walks back across the terrace, past the splayed bodies of the Rasanga, to the northern edge from which Stilts and Mansari fell. It is still very windy. He has to argue with his feet before they bear him to the edge. The morning mist has fallen by 100 feet. He stares down into the drifting whiteness, probing for some glimpse of the land below. Who were you, Stilts? Pale ghosts at the foot of the precipice, boulders or treetops. He cannot tell. What made you betray us? And what in Jekka's hell made you fall? A sea of cotton, churning. Then suddenly, a moment's clarity. Yes, those are cedar trees below, and something caught in their branches. Something rippling, voluminous, like the sail of a ship. The wind gusts. Condry lurches back from the cliff. When he creeps forward again, the mists have closed. Thoughtful, he crosses the terrace again, this time to the western edge, which none of them have yet approached. The sun is warm against his back. He knows he is too far to see the coastal range, but surely he will see Mab Makutin and the rim of the Stolen Sea. And if he can glimpse the Iskralim, then he can imagine its farther shore, and the villages of the Mileya on the road to Eternity Camp. From there, home is in reach, as Mektu tried to tell him. A day's ride on a fast horse. But when he reaches the cliff, he knows that something is wrong. The Lutaral plain is still in shadow, but the colors are wrong. A gray-black stain, punctuated by countless tiny points of light, engulfs the land between the hills and Mab Makutin. For a few seconds, Condry thinks with horror that he is looking at the ashes of a single cataclysmic fire. But no, that's not it. Like the mist, the stain is churning. The points of light move to and fro. Lamps. Torches. Men. It is the 7th Legion. Not a detachment, not a brigade. Everyone. There is no other force of such size in western Uroth. They press to the very edge of the Iskralim. They surround Mab Makutin. They break against the feet of the Arig Hills. The Prophet has abandoned the northeast front, marched them here through the night, driven them like animals. She has lost her favorite son. He turns and looks at the survivors. Eshet is kneeling beside his brother. She has lifted his hand to her cheek. Mektu is lying flat on his back, eyes open, drinking in the dawn. And her wrath is beyond description. Well then, why describe it? Why mention it at all? He walks back across the terrace. Eshet rises and meets him a few paces from Mektu. That woman, she says, glancing at the silver-haired warrior with the spear. The one Spider argued with at Apuk's Mill. Do you know who she is? Telepeke's grandmother?
Eshet nods. Kareka. Stilts's older sister. The founder of the circus, the one who put a roof over Tabasa's head when the plague took his family. She's 12 years older than the general.
Jashar, says Condri.
Some people only rest in the grave.